Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development, February 2nd, 2009, Hearing Room B, 3 p.m., Senator Dianne Rosenbaum, Chair.
might be interested in seeing it. So it looks, it doesn't really have, yeah, you're looking at the right piece of paper. It looks like this, and if you need another copy. But it does show county by county for all of our counties what their rates of unemployment were the first of the month or the last 3 months. So thank you, Jeremy, for...
I'm not seeing Deschutes.
It's two-sided.
Huh. So they're not alphabetical order necessarily.
That's it. Well... Yes, it is.
Are you looking for individual counties?
Yeah, we're looking.
The, on the first list, the there are metropolitan areas, and those are, I believe, the same as the counties. If you look on the first page.
Right. It says at the bottom that the Bend MSA includes all of Deschutes County. So I guess you have to look at Bend.
Bend at the very beginning.
Yeah.
With those metropolitan areas, they aggregate the figures for those metropolitan areas because they're considered one work area. And in the case of Bend, it's the same as the county.
Oh, it is. Okay.
I think that's my understanding.
So, I'm sure we'll have a chance to look at these numbers, these unfortunate numbers, again, repeatedly during session. So, I will call before us Kate Newhoff from the Bureau of Labor, and I believe she has with her Christy Hammond, the Administrator of the Wage and Hours Division. Thanks for joining us, and please tell us what you do.
So, good afternoon. My name is Kate Newhall, and I'm with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm happy to be here today to introduce myself to the committee and to reintroduce myself to many of you in a relatively new capacity as the Legislative and Communications Director at BOLI. I'm here today to provide the committee with a brief overview of BOLI and the services we provide to employers, employees, job seekers, and apprentices in Oregon. And I apologize, I came today prepared to do a brief overview of the entire agency, so I'm just going to do that testimony of BOLI entirely, and in it, it will include an overview of the Wage and Hour Division.
And that is what we expected, so
good.
That's great.
So I know many of you are already familiar with the Bureau, so I'm going to provide a brief sketch of the agency today. But I would also like to provide the committee with a general overview brochure that we encourage you to share with your staff and constituents for easy references when seeking the services provided by the Bureau. And within that brochure are contact information, phone numbers, and websites for each of the divisions that I'm about to describe to you. So let me start my testimony by sharing the principal mission of the Bureau. The agency's mission is to protect employment rights, advance employment opportunities, and protect access to housing and public accommodations free from discrimination. As an agency, the Bureau accomplishes this mission through four principal divisions and units: our Civil Rights Division, our Wage and Hour Division, the Technical Assistance for Employers Unit, and the Apprenticeship and Training Division. First, our Civil Rights Division works to protect the rights of workers and citizens to equal non-discriminatory treatment. The division enforces laws granting job seekers and employers equal access to jobs, career schools, promotions, and a work environment free from discrimination or harassment. These laws ensure workers job protection when they report workplace safety violations, use family leave provisions, or file for workers' compensation. The division also enforces civil rights laws that provide protection for those seeking housing or using public accommodations. Just a few quick facts about the division. In enforcing civil rights laws, the Civil Rights Division fields an average of 25,000 inquiries annually and investigates approximately 2,200 discrimination cases each year. Next, the Bureau's Wage and Hour Division works to enforce compliance with the state's laws relating to wages, hours, and the terms and conditions of employment. These laws include wage and hour laws governing minimum wage and overtime, meal and rest period provisions, and the state's prevailing wage law. The division also certifies the employment of miners and farm and forest labor contractors. The bills that you have before you today deal with technical amendments to the state's prevailing wage law, or PWR law. State prevailing wage law requires that workers on public construction projects be paid wages and benefits found to be prevailing for similar work in or near the same location. In Oregon, prevailing wage rates are set based on an annual survey of construction occupations conducted by the Oregon Employment Department. Contractor responses to the PWR survey are compiled by the Employment Department and then used to establish prevailing wage rates for construction occupations in each of 14 regions in the state. The Bureau works to enforce compliance with Oregon's prevailing wage law and educate Oregon contractors and contracting agencies on the proper application of and compliance with Oregon PWR law. The Wage and Hour Division investigates approximately 2,500 wage claims a year and conducts about 200 prevailing wage rate compliance reviews each year. Next, our Technical Assistance for Employers program. For employers in Oregon, and in order to help them understand and comply with state and federal employment law, the Bureau's Technical Assistance program works to educate and train employers. The TA unit is an employment law resource for employers. It answers employers' questions via free telephone hotline and email inquiries. It also provides 4 fee seminars and handbooks on various employment law topics. The unit's manager and 2 program coordinators answer between 100 and 150 calls and emails each day from public and private employers. They also conduct nearly 200 seminars annually and distribute a weekly news article on employment-related issues to 16 newspapers and business associations. What is particularly nice about the Technical Assistance for Employers unit is that it allows employers to get employment law information directly from the enforcement agency. And last, but certainly not least, the Bureau works to promote the development of a highly skilled and competitive workforce through our Apprenticeship and Training Division. Apprenticeship programs provide supervised, structured training for high-skilled jobs. And the Bureau works to ensure that we have high-quality apprenticeship programs in Oregon. Apprenticeship programs combine theoretical knowledge, classroom learning, and 2 to 5 years of hands-on, paid work experiences. Apprentices work to gain journey-level certification as electricians, heavy equipment operators, plumbers, pipe fitters, and many other skilled trades. They gain certification in these trades based on a recognized set of skill standards. The Apprenticeship and Training Division at Boley serves to certify apprenticeship programs and register individual apprentices in Oregon. The division works to ensure program compliance with training standards that are approved by the Oregon State Apprenticeship Council. Boley also works with individual programs and local training councils to ensure proper compliance with these approved standards and to promote apprenticeship generally in Oregon. That, in a nutshell, is the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We are committed to serving both Oregon's employers and their employees and the promotion of a high-skill and competitive workforce in Oregon. With that, I will end my testimony, but will be happy to answer any questions the committee may have, and again, encourage you to share the information and contact resources found in our brochure with your constituents, staff, and anybody else who might benefit or need our services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you, Kate. And Christy, did you have overview comments, or were you primarily here to talk about the bills before?
Senator Rosenbaum, I'm here to address Senate bills 53 and 55.
Great. Okay. So were there any questions about the general outlines of what the Bureau of Labor and Industry does? Yes. Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kate, you mentioned about prevailing wage, about how it was put together, and you may not be the person, I'm not sure either of you, whether you are or not. You talked about the idea that the way we come up with prevailing wage in the state is we do a survey of the contractors. And it seems like to me that, and I just don't understand it, so if you just kind of do a quick overview for me, I would appreciate it. It seems like to me, in essence, you could, if I'm a contractor and I make 10% on every contract I make for the public, if I'm doing a $10 million contract, I'm making 10%, I'm making $1 million. But if that contract is $20 million because the wage is higher, I make $2 million on the same exact project. So it seems like there's a vested interest in bigger firms to inflate wages on public projects because they make a percentage of whatever the increase is. How do we make sure we're checking ourselves wage-wise so that we don't have people gaming that system, artificially raising wages and making public entities pay a higher wage than would be in really a prevailing wage around the country?
I'm going to let Christy, who administers our wage and hour division and our prevailing wage rate unit, answer your question.
Thank you.
Well, Senator Rosenbaum, Senator George, let me just briefly describe the survey because I'm not sure I altogether understand your question, and maybe my summary of the survey will respond to it. We survey every construction contractor in the state for the wage rates that they pay to their construction workers on non-commercial, on commercial construction projects only, and that those include public works projects. So every commercial contract should be surveyed in the survey. The contractor chooses their peak week of construction activity in the previous calendar year and reports the payroll that they paid during that week on a commercial project. So it may be a public works project, but most of the projects that are surveyed are not public works projects.
Madam Chair?
Yes, follow up?
Yeah, if I could. I guess what I'm trying to get at is that there's an inherent conflict of interest between those people who are reporting to you. Both the workers and the employer have a vested interest in inflating that number for the report, in as much as both of them make more money. So I'm wondering, on a check and balance system, when you're talking about prevailing wage, an employer who pays prevailing wage, it's in essence a way to price fix. Everybody pays, in essence, the same prevailing wage on a project. We do it in agriculture, and they're called marketing orders. It's a way for the industry to price fix and get around monopoly laws. But what you could do is that employers could fix that system so that public entities are paying a higher price. And, of course, a contractor who pays a higher prevailing wage mandated by the state makes his or her margin off of that higher prevailing wage. So you have vested interests, both in the employer and the employee, to inflate that number, because they're both the beneficiaries. And I'm just wondering how there's a check on the system to make sure that it's competitive with Idaho, Nevada, California, Washington, that we're just not listening in an echo chamber and with people sort of gaming the system.
And thank you for that editorial comment. Question. It may be that what we're really looking for, it sounds like, is an overview of why we have a prevailing wage law and what that law is, and then how that survey is done, which we could certainly do because I think we have plenty of time today, in addition to the bills before us. Is that maybe what the committee would like to hear?
Madam Chair, actually, what happened was a senator last session brought to me prevailing wage in other surrounding states and was showing a differential between our state and surrounding states. And
there's a lot of factors that would have to be taken into consideration.
Absolutely. And so what I'm trying to do is understand how that survey comes to an effect, because in essence you could have, there's nobody sort of, the fox is guarding the hen house on that. The employer is reporting to us, but the employer makes a margin off of what they report to us, so they have a vested interest in coming up with a higher price. And all I'm trying to make sure is that the state has a system in there to make sure we're protecting state and local governments, and I don't know how that process works, so I was looking for an overview of some sort. So,
and I'd be happy to let the witnesses respond. I did not ask anybody to come prepared with information comparing Oregon's stats to other states today. So, but if you've got some comments or answers to that question, and yes, did you have a clarification for your presenter?
I guess maybe, from what I'm hearing, the way the process works, there's a peak week, and how that's going to be defined as to what that means. And then everyone, whatever their peak week is, will be reporting the jobs that their company is involved in and what their wages are. Then there's some type of averaging across the board or based on the geographic areas, and saying everyone in the, as they would define tier, the Portland, Vancouver, Beaverton, MSA, this would be the wage that we'd be looking at as compared to someone other part of the state.
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Przanski, that's pretty close to the way it works. The law does say that if the same wage is paid to a majority of workers in a particular craft in a particular region, that rate of pay is the prevailing wage rate, which is why some people think that the prevailing wage rates are union rates. If in the course of the survey it's determined that the majority of the workers in a particular trade in a particular region are union workers, that rate is the prevailing rate for that trade and region, and union rates are published as the prevailing wage rates. If the majority of workers are not paid the same rate in a particular locality, then we do look at the average rate paid to those workers in that locality and publish an average pay rate for that trade or occupation.
Okay. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, if we could. Sometime, if we do have time, I'd love to have an overview of this, because I do wonder who's watching how that process goes forward. And I'd hate to see us not advocating for the best deal we possibly can in these tough times, both for cities, counties, and our state projects. And I'd hate to see somebody gaming that system. So if I get some overview sometime, or even you can just come to my office, if the committee doesn't want to do it, that'd be great.
And I think Chair Rosenbaum and Senator George, we would the Oregon Employment Department actually conducts the survey for Boley, so I would like to involve them in that conversation as well, since they're the ones that actually do the survey for us.
Thank you.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you for your overview, and I think that completes the informational meeting. So next I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 53, and I think I'll also open a public hearing on Senate Bill 55 at the same time. And we have witness sheets out in the audience. I'm not sure if anybody has signed up on those, but certainly our first witnesses are in front of us. Jeremy, first, would you like to tell us about Senate Bill 53?
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, Senate Bill 53 does three things. It changes the time that public agency must pay the prevailing wage fee to the Bureau of Labor and Industries from the current time that the agency enters into the contract to the time that the agency notifies the commissioner a contract has been awarded. Secondly, it removes the requirement, as a technical fix, it removes the requirement that reference to the fee be included in public works contracts. And third, it requires contractors and subcontractors to pay all wages due on the contractor or subcontractor's regular payday.
Thank you, Mr. Committee Administrator. And it looks like we have two people signed up on this bill, and they are in front of us. So Kate Newhall and Christy Hammond, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Your committee administrator is correct. We characterize the amendments in Senate Bill 53 as technical fixes, two of which were made necessary by legislation enacted last session and things that were inadvertently missed in making changes in House Bill 2140. As the committee administrator indicated, House Bill 2140 shifted responsibility last session for payment of the prevailing wage rate fee from the contractor to the contracting agency. So now contracting agencies pay the same fee that was paid by contractors prior to House Bill 2140 being enacted. There's still language in the statute, however, that refers to the fee being paid by contractors, and specifically ORS 279830 requires that contracting agencies include language in the contract specifications referencing the fee being paid by a contractor. So House or Senate Bill 53 would remove that language that erroneously refers to contractors paying the fee. The second technical fix in Senate Bill 53 also relates to the timing of the payment of the prevailing wage rate fee by contracting agencies. And as was indicated, the current language indicates that the fee is payable at the time the public contracting agency enters into the public works contract, which is fine, except for there's a separate provision in the prevailing wage rate law that requires contracting agencies to provide notification to Boley when a public contract has been awarded. And that's not required until 30 days after the notice of the contract is awarded. So we have the fee sometimes coming in. The fee is payable to Boley before the notice of contract award is required to be submitted to the agency. So it's possible for us to get a fee payment without knowing what contract it relates to. It makes more sense to have both the notice of contract award and the fee payment coming in together at the same time. So that's what Senate Bill 53 proposes, and it's proposed that both of those be submitted within 30 days of the date that the contract is awarded. The last fix in Senate Bill 53 relates to a surprise court ruling that was issued in October 2007 by the Oregon Supreme Court, which found that although the payment of prevailing wages is required under the prevailing wage rate law, the prevailing wage rate law itself doesn't have any timeline for the payment of PWR wages. So long as a contractor eventually pays the applicable prevailing wage rate, it doesn't really matter when the contractor pays that amount. And that's problematic because the prevailing wage rate law also has a provision for liquidated damages in the event the prevailing wage rates that are required are not paid by a contractor. And if a contractor can simply pay the prevailing wage rate that were due 2 years ago in order to avoid the assessment of those liquidated damages, they can do so. So Senate Bill 53 would require that contractors pay prevailing wages that are owed on their regularly scheduled paydays and not just at any particular at any time. Those are the three issues that are addressed in Senate Bill 53.
Yes, Senator Munison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there another reason why they maybe not pay on the contractor day because of a cash flow problem?
Well, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Monis Anderson, I suppose that's possible, but that would still be a violation of the law by not paying wages on a regular payday under the regular wage and hour laws. It just technically wouldn't be a violation of the prevailing wage rate law. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, well, just to follow up, now that we're in the a crisis in particular, a really bad crisis regarding lending from banks, it's, this is going to be a huge, this could be a huge issue. Maybe I'm reading this wrong, but it just seems that if contractors who get their money from the banks and then all of a sudden the banks are having all sorts of problems, and then this was one way that the contractor could get out of, at least until they could get the money that they are supposedly hopefully getting through their banks. I mean, that's just an example. I don't know if that really is a problem or not.
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Monis Anderson, employers are still technically required to pay wages due to their employees regardless of their financial status. There are exceptions from the penalty provisions in wage and hour law if an employer is financially unable to pay wages due. But that doesn't excuse an employer from paying wages that employees are entitled to on their regularly mm-hmm. scheduled paydays. And the law does require employers to establish and maintain regularly scheduled paydays.
Just a follow-up. Oh, I think of all of the suicides in the Bend area in particular of contractors committing suicide because of the financial mess they got themselves into, that may be a much broader question than what this fix is trying to do. I'm sort of maybe opening up Pandora's box in trying to work with the contractors on some of the problems that they have been facing, especially in the last year.
Okay. Any other questions? So why don't we move on to Senate Bill 55.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just trying to figure out if I wanted to... Thank you, Madam Chair. I just a question regarding the banks. Most of these, and the suicides, there have been three, and only two have been confirmed related. But the question I have is, on a drawdown schedule, if we're talking about banks, the bank has already approved the loan. It's just merely a drawdown schedule to pay payroll. So that there are banks reneging on?
I don't know.
That?
That's what I was
Senator
asking.
Rosenbaum, Senator Telfer, I don't think that is what this bill is trying to address. this bill, frankly, we had this concept in mind before the economy situation occurred. This bill was just meant to clarify that, like other wage and hour law requirements, when the prevailing wage rates are owed to an employee is on their regularly scheduled payday.
Just follow up, just to clarify. So if a contractor is having problems with cash flow problems, say from the lender, and I'm only talking because of the economy that we're in right now, does he have, and you find, I mean, there's a complaint given to you, and he then appeals the fact that he wasn't able to is because of the lending from the lender wasn't able to give him the money. What happens in that case then?
Well, Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Montes Anderson, we always try to work with a contractor to get the employees paid, even if it means making payments. If an employer goes out of business and is without sufficient assets to pay final wages owed, there is a wage security fund that's available to pay workers in this state. But frankly, if an employer continues to employ employees and is unable to pay those employees, at some point they probably shouldn't be employing employees anymore. And we see that situation as well.
Thank you.
Thanks. I mean, it is really beyond the scope of this bill, but I think there have been some well-publicized instances lately of people who've been working without a paycheck for many months at a time because they're, you know, they're being told, we don't have any money coming in the door, we hope things will get better. People keep showing up for work sort of on the promise that maybe someday things will get better and they'll get paid, but you obviously don't want the Wage Security Fund, which is funded in order to protect in those situations, to be sort of in lieu of keeping people on the payroll when there's no money to pay them. So you can't have a system that just sort of operates on monopoly money. At some point, you have to sort of let people know that they're not going to be paid and they can choose to not show up for work if they're not going to be paid. So, okay, so let's move on to Senate Bill 55.
Okay, thank you.
And let's let Jeremy tell us about it.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 55 provides that a contractor or subcontractor that intentionally falsifies information on certified and statements concerning payment of prevailing wage on public works contracts is ineligible to receive any public works contract for 3 years. You can explain what that means.
Thank you. One of the requirements under the prevailing wage rate law is for contractors to submit certified payroll records to the contracting agency showing what they are classifying their workers as for purposes of the prevailing wage rate project, their occupation, what the earnings are for each employee each week, how many hours they work, what fringe benefits are paid, things like that. Occasionally, we will see a certified payroll that has been intentionally falsified by a contractor in order to conceal the underpayment of either the prevailing wage rate that's required or that the worker has worked overtime and is entitled to overtime. Although we have the authority to place a contractor on the list of ineligibles, which we call debar that contractor, if we can show or prove that the employer has intentionally failed to pay the prevailing wage rate, we don't have the authority to debar a contractor for intentionally falsifying their payroll records to conceal the underpayment of prevailing wages. And in addition, the requirements to pay overtime on public works contracts are not within the prevailing wage rate law. So if an employer on a public works contract fails to pay overtime as required by the public contracting code, which is broader than the prevailing wage rate law, we don't have the authority under the prevailing wage rate law to debar that contractor for that violation. We can collect the back payment of overtime wages, but the failure to pay overtime is not technically a violation of the prevailing wage rate law. It's a violation of the public contracting code, which is ORS Chapter 279, the prevailing wage rate law is part of that public contracting code in 279 Section C. So Senate Bill 55 would add the intentional falsification of payroll records as an offense for which the agency could debar a contractor. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I'm sure.
And just a moment, Senator Pozanski, I should have had you identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries.
Thank you. And Senator Pozanski, please go ahead.
So while I'm hearing, Christy, this is kind of like, I'm going to say, clearing up a situation that may be on the books can be enforced one way, but will allow you to enforce it under the prevailing wage arena. Do we gain anything else besides that by having them held accountable for that type of violation versus a general employment contract rules, whatever phrase that you had used?
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Pozanski, I'm not sure I understand the question. We do currently have the authority to pursue the payment of unpaid overtime and collect those underpayments. It's very difficult, though, to take action against a contractor beyond that collection of back wages for their intentionally falsifying their records to conceal that they did not pay overtime. And this would remedy that situation. I should also add, Kate reminded me to advise you that the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee has reviewed and supported this concept as well.
Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Based on that answer, is this bill then expanding the regulatory authority on unpaid wages beyond to the prevailing wage rules?
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Telfer, no, it does not expand our authority to collect back overtime wages or expand the requirement to pay overtime wages. It would simply add as an offense for which a contractor could be debarred the intentional falsification of their payroll records.
Follow up. So, in fact, it's giving it more an additional avenue of recourse by debarring from future contracts that they don't have. These types of employers don't have in non-prevailing wage jobs where you're just being able to collect back wages.
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Telfer, it would provide an additional ground for a contractor to be debarred.
And I think the intent is on the pattern, the ability to put them on the ineligible contractor list creates a way that you don't have the same contractor with a pattern of non-payment of wages. Or falsifying records. So I think it is a mechanism. Yes, they can attempt to collect the overtime wages through wage and hour law, but there's not a way to prevent that same contractor from repeating the offense.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Pozanski.
So, I mean, I think what I'm still stumbling over is it sounds like if they don't pay the overtime, you can go after them for the overtime. And it doesn't make a difference if it's a prevailing wage job or not. You can do that right now. But what I'm hearing is because the way this is not included under the proposal under SB 55, you can't, or it's more difficult at least, to hold them accountable for the intentional act of not paying the true wages because they falsified their records. So I guess the question I'm stuck with is, it sounds like what you want to be able to do is have grounds for, as we're using the term, debarring, meaning that they would not be allowed to contract or bid on public wage contracts?
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Pozanski, that's exactly right. The debarment, the maximum debarment period is 3-year period.
And what does that mean for them in doing any other type of contracting work. In the private sector, they're free to go out there and continue to do that, and if they're falsifying records there as to how much they owe an employee, there's no debarring sanctions.
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Pozanski, there is not. They would be debarred from public contracting only.
Right. So, Madam Chair, if I understand this, that now is basically you've got a contractor who could be intentionally doing this in a non-public contracting arena, and the only thing that the agency can do is gather or have them pay for the back wages that are owed. But the contractor can continue to do that practice. But if they're in the arena of doing public wage work, public contracting, there you could actually have the extra penalty of saying, because you've done this and it is intentional, and your pattern and practice demonstrates that you've done this two or three times over some period of time, we're now going to put you on the list that keeps you from being able to bid on these contracts for a three-year period.
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Pozanski, that's correct. There's not a requirement that necessarily that they have violated that provision of the law two or three times,
right.
Only that they intentionally violated the law.
Right. So one other question then.
Yeah, follow up.
So basically, we have a potential that you can have a bad actor who continues to be a bad actor with no sanctions of having them maybe lose their license through CCB, even though they may be ripping people off because it's not a public contract?
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Pozanski, not exactly. There is civil penalty authority under the general wage and hour laws for failure to pay overtime. And if we had assessed a civil penalty against a contractor for that violation, and there might be a way to revoke their contractor's license in that situation.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Senator George.
Thanks. I had two questions, but I think you sort of answered them both with Senator Pozanski's comments. So currently, right now, there is a penalty if a contractor violates the law, does not pay overtime, there you collect back the back wages, and then there's also a civil penalties portion of it, so they're already being punished for that.
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator George, we may assess a civil penalty. We do have the authority to assess a civil penalty for failing to pay overtime.
And the follow-up?
Follow-up.
And I guess for me is that I think, Kate, you mentioned the idea that when it's a repeat offender, in my mind, blackballing somebody from all future projects is a pretty significant step. So you really need to make sure that this person is actually intentionally a bad player. So it seems like I can't find in the bill anywhere that this could happen to a first time person, the first time they violate the law in this place. And if you're gonna actually blackball them, it seems like to me that it would be better as if there was a finding of fact, a civil penalty posted, and then after that they did it again, then they're banned from bidding on projects. Why wasn't it drafted in more of a...
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator George, they in fact would have that right. In order to debar a contractor, we have to go through the Administrative Procedures Act. We have to notify the contractor of that potential debarment as a proposed action on our part. The contractor has the right to request a contested case hearing before an administrative law judge and put on their case, and the burden is actually on the Bureau to prove that the contractor has intentionally violated the law. The employer contractor does have the right to contest that proceeding and provide their evidence. So it's a pretty high standard to show that a contractor has intentionally violated the law. We would have to have contradictory payroll records, and the contractor would be given the right to explain why the records are contradictory. So we would have already crossed that bridge before we get to the hearing and have some reason to believe that the contractor intentionally failed or intentionally concealed an underpayment in their records and intentionally falsified their records.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I I'd like to see kind of a one-strike situation in the bill, perhaps even more so. But I also understand the role of bad players in the industry, so it's a public policy decision. So I'm going to have to weigh that, and I think that's my. I think if it was a one-strike deal, I'd be much more comfortable with it. But
I'm wondering if it might help to, without violating any confidential information in this process, to have an example of a case that might be subject to this, because it seems like intentional falsification of records is a pretty high standard to prove. I mean, obviously, errors, good faith errors, are not intentional falsification of records. So I would assume you have to have evidence that records were deliberately altered or other than simple, you know, errors that happen, and everybody has occasionally had a paycheck. I think we get them around here occasionally that are wrong, and then we get one that has an adjustment on the next month. So that would not be what we're talking about.
No, Senator Rosenbaum. I mean, these are situations, a lot of times the employees come to us and say, my employer is falsifying the time records, and I'm working overtime, and they're making it look in the time records like I'm not working overtime. So we have information from other sources, and then sometimes we just compare the payroll records that the employer has at the contractor's place of business with what they're writing in on the certified payroll records, and they don't even match up. So we have to have corroborating evidence to be able to prove that there's intentional failure on the contractor's part.
I wanted to ask you, too, you had mentioned the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, and you didn't talk about that in your overview, so could you tell us what is the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee?
Sure, Senator Rosenbaum. There's a Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee that's been in place since, I believe, 1995, that is charged legislatively with advising the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries on issues relating to administration of the prevailing wage rate law. The requirement is that there be equal representation on that committee from representatives of labor and management. Currently, we have 11 members, five representing labor, five representing management, and one that is with the Fair Contracting Foundation that represents both. That committee meets on a regular basis and reviews various issues related to enforcement of the prevailing wage rate law. All of the bills that are being proposed this session relating to the prevailing wage rate law have been reviewed by the advisory committee, and we've received input from them on all the proposed legislation.
Okay. Well, seeing no further questions. Yes, Senator Monashan.
Thank you. While they're here, it isn't regarding overtime, but is it falsifying records if a contractor does have employees that they pay prevailing wage rate, but then also hire people who they do not pay prevailing wage rate?
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Montes-Anderson, we already have the authority to debar a contractor who intentionally fails to pay prevailing wages. And so if we have a contractor that has workers on a covered project and is paying some of the workers the prevailing wage rate, but it's clear they're intentionally not paying other workers the prevailing wage rate, we would have the authority to initiate a debarment proceeding in that situation.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you very much for your testimony. And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 55, and I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 53. And members, we are meeting again on Wednesday at 3 o'clock. We will be taking up again Senate Bill 110 that you will remember, I think, from last week, as well as these two bills. So you have additional information that you need about any three of those bills prior to our hearing on Wednesday. Please do get your questions to our capable committee administrator, and we will do our best to get you the information that you need. With nothing further to come before us today, committee, we are adjourned.